Hi, I'm Pat Kelly.
And I'm Peter Oldring, and we're the hosts of This Is That.
Are you kidding?
For over a decade, we were radio's go-to source for completely fabricated news.
You must be joking me.
And now, we're back in podcast form.
We've selected some of our favorite stories from over the years and put them in one convenient location.
Sugar in the tap water.
Bilingual dog park. Charging to see wildlife.
This Is That, coming soon on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Q. So today you're going to hear my conversation with the legendary folk singer Joan Baez. And it would be a crime if we didn't start out by listening to Joan Baez.
Don't sing love songs. You'll wake my mother. She's sleeping here, right by my side.
Joan Baez and the Silver Dagger, an old song from the 17th century. I remember hearing that song on this old Bob Dylan live record that came out. These bootleg series records came out. I was blown away by it. I never really paid much attention to Joan Baez for whatever, probably not great reason as a young music listener. And then I remember listening to that and just becoming a fan automatically. And then learning so much more about her. I mean, just an incredibly influential voice in modern music. There's so many artists that have been influenced by her that probably don't even know they're being influenced by her. Also an incredible activist, like, you know, especially during Vietnam, but marched on Washington, marched in Montgomery, Alabama with Martin Luther King Jr. So leaves behind this incredible legacy already now in her 80s. But was it an honest legacy? That's the kind of question that Joan Baez has been asking herself. And it's been surprising to a lot of her fans because they thought, well, this is someone who's been pretty honest throughout her whole life. That's kind of the thing about folk music. So we had a chat with her a couple of months ago about this new documentary called Joan Baez, I Am a Noise, where she sort of reveals some truth that she hadn't revealed up to that point. And we figured we'd play it for you because Joan Baez went into the archives to find this truth about herself. She also found a bunch of poems. She just released her first ever book of poetry, and it's out now. So let's revisit it. Here's my conversation with the legendary Joan Baez. Joan, you gave a lot to this documentary. I mean, diaries, home family movies. I was particularly struck by, like, tapes of therapy. Yeah. Talk to me about how that felt to give that stuff to somebody.
Well, you have to totally trust, which I did. I've been friends with Karen O'Connor, director, one of the three directors, for decades. So I knew her as a friend. I also knew her as a filmmaker. And her films were, you know, they were magnificent. So I knew what I was stepping into. I knew that I wouldn't know when I had, you know, we started off as a movie about my last tour. And then one day I just handed them the key to my storage unit. I'd never been in there. So in the film, when I walk in, that's the first time I'd ever been in there. So I was as stunned as anybody else to find the extent of what my mom had kept, you know, and from childhood, from early childhood, my father was a camera buff and he had 8mm and he took pictures of us kids from the very beginning. So that was in there. And then the tapes, I remember making tapes to my mother and father from being on the road at age 21, but I had never heard them back. So it was a total trust. Here are the keys. I'm out of here. And that's what made the film what it is.
How did you feel when you heard them back?
Different things. Some things that I thought were, you know, for me were splendid. And some things were just too sorrowful to even think about. You know, my father saying, I wish we were closer. I love you. Goodbye, honey. Whoa. You know, each time I hear it, it's just heart-wrenching. And, you know, and my son as well, for all the years we've had to make up for it. Still, when he was little, I saw the degree to which he felt that his mother's presence was a non-presence. Those were important things for me to hear.
Don't sing love songs. You'll wake my mother. She's sleeping here.
Your family comes up so much in the film, and I just kind of want to go into some of the meat of the stories that are told in the film. And I'll start out by talking about some of the early days. You know, you're singing songs with your sister, you're singing songs on your own. This has always been very idyllic to me. I talked to Margaret Atwood about this one time, about like seeing you in Boston when you were, you know, when you were still playing coffee houses, and then you become the big thing. Like pretty quickly, you become the big thing in American music. You're on the cover of Time magazine, and like Joan Baez becomes the kind of the symbol of the new folk movement. And I have never seen a documentary talk about this before, that kind of fame can have, and money can have, an impact on your family.
Yeah. I didn't realize it either till I hear them talking about you know, me throwing money around to my family. Here, you guys, you can have this. And then how it was infuriating to my father. And my sisters were confused by it. And for my father, my sudden being recognized like that was a challenge. And like, you know, like a lot of people, I've heard the father will boast about them to other people, but can't really bring himself to say, that was great, honey. You know, many, many layers to all of this.
I thought he would have been like just proud that you were making money and he wouldn't have to worry about you. Like, I was surprised that he had this feeling of, well, you know, I had to work for every dollar I had, and you're just getting up and singing songs.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I understand it now, but, you know, it was hard for me. Because I wanted to make everybody happy, and that seemed to be impossible. And also, you know, in the film, I began to see really why my older sister had to move away and become invisible. That she, you know, I sucked all the oxygen out of the room, and I hadn't known to which degree that affected her, that it was that more than anything else. It was her famous sister that, you know, that where she had to go somewhere where she could just be without the shadow.
Right. And your other sister wants to sing, and she wants to be a performer, but she's also, you know, there's recordings of her in the press being compared to her sister.
Yeah. And, you know, and that thing that I say in the film, she asked me what I think of her pursuing this as a career. And I said, it's going to be hard to always be in my shadow. And, you know, I mean, her mind was already set, and maybe I should have said, absolutely, just go for it. Maybe I should have said that. And I was trying to, but I was being honest. I was thinking, it's going to be so difficult. And it was. And still, she still resented my having said that. Kind of a no-win situation.
Go away from my window. Go at your own chosen speed. I'm not the one you want, babe. I'm not the one you need.
I realize I'm probably never going to get a chance to talk to you again, unless I'm very lucky. So I wanted to ask you this, because I'm always very curious. I come from folk music, too. That's what I did up until I started hosting the show. I toured around playing traditional music and that kind of stuff, right? And you are one of the greatest, like, interpreters of folk song to me. And the reason behind that, and I can really see this in the film, is that you sing these very well-known songs like, you know, Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, and like Silver Dagger. You manage to keep the integrity of the original traditional song while very much making it your own. Is there a guiding principle to how you approach that?
Not consciously, I'm sure. The first thing that comes to my mind is the image I have of myself wanting to keep my feet planted on the ground in the earth. I didn't want to be an opera singer because that, you know, something too highfalutin about it, although I could have been. It was Pete Seeger and the people I saw doing what they sang about. And that had a huge impression on me. But the early, I didn't write, you know, for the first 10 years. So the early music was steeped in tradition. I mean, I had this thing where it had to be traditional, as in I couldn't learn it from a book. I had to learn it from another person who learned it from his grandpa or whatever the hell was going on, you know. And so purity was a big deal in that. And then I'm guessing I'm shooting from the hip here, this singing to the public and watching their reaction to see where I wanted them to join in and be part of it. Plus, over the years, getting over my stiffness about it so that I could, I could evolve into something less strict and, you know, give my voice and myself a little more room to sing and for joy.
The film goes on to talk about sort of the changes in the folk music scene, especially when Bob Dylan starts coming around. Joan, I love that you call him Bobby in the film.
That's funny, yeah. He was Bobby. You know, I sang a dedication to John Prine when he was in the audience one time. I called him Bobby because that's how I knew him. And his wife apparently commented later about nobody calls him Bobby anymore. Nobody calls me Joni anymore. You know, we were kids. We had baby fat still, Bob and me.
What was that like when he first came on the scene? Like, what was he? He seemed like a bit of a ragamuffin there, just kind of showing up.
You know, it says so in the film, too. I mean, it was a ragamuffin. He was more than a ragamuffin. He liked his ragamuffinness. And apparently I did, too. You know, it brings out the mother in you. I remember I bought him that jacket, that black jacket, and he wore it to please me, but he hated it. He wanted this weird, bratty little jacket look, so he threw up on it, and he was happy with that.
How many roads does a man walk down before you call him a man?
I mean, he was an extraordinary individual, and all of those things included, you know, his ragamuffin-ness. And then, you know, out of all that carved, you know, out of this rose quartz, and you chip off the edges, and there was this extraordinary talent inside there. And, you know, whatever he did before or after, I kind of categorize as artist liberty, because nobody else could give us songs like that.
My friend is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
Your relationship with Bob has been sort of well speculated about and well written about over the years, and it was great in the documentary to see it from your perspective. Mm-hmm. What side of that relationship do you think this documentary reveals?
The first thing that comes to my mind is that moment when he's so, everybody's, you know, critical of him, saying, no, he didn't have a girlfriend. He was so young. I don't know what was going on in his head. But back then you feel rejected and go through all the stuff that we went through. And I think it's important for me to just say that what happened in the last few years, I was painting his portrait from that period when he looked like that when he was a kid. And I put on this music and I started to cry, and I wept for, you know, painting that portrait for days, and I, on and off, I was just weeping and feeling nothing but gratitude. All of the bullshit just fell away. And I thought, for the timing, for his relationship with me, for the music, for our closeness, all of it. And that has remained that way. I have nothing bad to say. I mean, I'll joke about him because he's a nutcase, but it's not resentful and all the things it was for so many years.
I love that, though, that when you were painting his portrait, anything you were holding on to just sort of slipped away.
It just really, it was epiphany. I was really amazed. I had no plans for that. It just happened, and it's been wonderful.
I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. More of my conversation with Joan Baez coming up.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention. but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
You know, much of this documentary also focuses on your activism, your anti-war activism, your humanitarian activism. I wanted to play a clip for you. Just take a listen to this.
Good evening. Welcome to Sunday. Tonight in the Bear Pit, to sing and to talk, one of the world's great singers, Miss Joan Baez.
From 1967 on CBC's Sunday, that's a little bit of Joan Baez on that show. Canada comes up. This is a Canadian show, and Canada comes up a handful of times in the show. You know, in the documentary, there's one audio journal where you remember a performance in Vancouver. There's a diary. There's a letter you write, and it's sent from the Chateau Laurier in Ottawa. How do you look back on your relationship with Canada back then?
It was always good. What I'm remembering is at the beginning when you were still doing the British national anthem. Yeah, they're playing God Save the Queen. It says, I have this thing about refusing to salute the American flag. I refuse to salute anybody's flag. So I'd have to stash myself backstage until it was over. anthems, and then I would come out guilt-free. I remember joking about the fact that they were smart audiences, probably smarter than the U.S. audiences. I made myself popular in the States, but that's how I felt.
Did Canada help you? Because I know Pete Seeger talked about when he was blacklisted, he could still perform in Canada. And when you were, you know, when you were deep in your anti-war activism, I know stages and TV shows weren't always welcome to you in the United States. Did Canada help you like that?
What happens in places like Canada and outside of my own United States was this a feeling of freedom, which I don't even know how I worked that out in my head. But yeah, there's a different kind of breathing of the air when you're somewhere that, you know, well, you're not going to be criticized, I assume. Although this has proved to me that I was doing the right thing.
I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q, my conversation with the legendary Joan Baez. We've been talking about her very personal documentary, Joan Baez, I Am a Noise. So I want to give you a heads up before we listen to this next part together. Joan opens up in this documentary and in our conversation for the very first time about abuse in her childhood, allegedly from her dad. She talks about how that experience led to mental health issues and panic attacks. And what the way she reveals this is by actually going into tapes of her therapy sessions and playing them in the documentary. So heads up, that's where we pick up our story. There are a couple of personal revelations in this film that we as fans of yours didn't know about. First, you talk about the debilitating panic attacks you went through your entire life. How did those attacks manifest? How debilitating were they?
They were, for instance, lying on the floor of the dressing room, shaking, sick to my stomach, and telling somebody finally to just get me up and kind of push me toward the stage because I was too terrified to just get up and walk there. When I got there, you know, it was okay, and I would sing. But, you know, there were, we didn't call them panic attacks back then, but it was just kind of one after another. And I would judge my time by the amount of time I had between them to, you know, enjoy myself or feel like a quasi-normal human being, and then it would strike again. It debilitating. It was debilitating.
The other revelation from the film are in those incredibly personal recordings you put out from the therapy sessions, where, you know, both your own therapy session, your sister Mimi's therapy sessions, and your parents' therapy sessions. And in them, the revelation is offered that you and your sister were abused as children. What was it like hearing those tapes again and having them in this film?
Well, what I realized is that what I want to do with them now is collect them all and have a nice big bonfire, because I've been through it for a second time. I've offered what I can to the public. You know, it's curated so that they really, in my mind, get what they can possibly absorb, because it's crazy, you know, that the tapes are crazy. I was crazy. And you try to fashion something that people will be able to understand at all. But for me, it's like other things in the film. I didn't remember those tapes. I mean, I remember those years, what was happening and collecting memories, which had been, you know, unconscious for half a century. And I always want to repeat what I said in the film, which is that for whatever degree that abuse happened, that my parents had no memory of it. I figure if I took a half a century to get down to that level to remember that, and they had no, I wanted to, and they didn't want to. So there remained denial and a block. And in the end, the forgiveness is all about the fact that they didn't remember, and they must have suffered the same thing, or they wouldn't have passed it on, because I believe that kind of abuse is generational.
It was a bit moving, I suppose, and unexpected, maybe, to hear a revelation like that, and then to see you and your mother together in her later years, and you and your father together in those later years too.
No, it was the only. Oh, there's some saying, I don't know where it came from, you can forgive a little bit and feel a little bit better, or you can forgive a lot and feel a lot better, or you can forgive everything and be free. And it feels as though I managed to reach that point with my parents.
The last, one of the last scenes in the film is one of my favorites. I think it's your last performance of your farewell tour, and you're at the Beacon Theater in New York. You're singing Dink Song. You're singing Fare Thee Well by yourself, and it's your last performance of your very last show.
Fare thee well.
Come off stage and you're hugging your band and you're hugging people. How did you feel in that moment?
I think I felt a sense of what was really going on. It'd be hard to absorb after 60 years of doing what I had just done and not knowing what I would feel like about it in the future. And sort of beginning to realize that I was losing that traveling family. Dirk and pals and the various musicians I'd had on and off for decades, that was done. So I knew it would take a while to really realize that. But that night, you know, we had prepared so much for it, the touring to be ending, that I think I had absorbed it enough so that I could just be present for the people who were there, whom I loved and worked with. There was a sense that this is it.
When you look back at this film and you get to see your honest life played out for you, is there something that you're most proud of?
You know, what comes to my mind is I'm most proud of the fact that I was able to become friends with my son. And that's because he was willing to go to therapy with me and figure it out. Yeah. It's not all the grand stuff. It's, you know, it's family. It's my boy. And being able to rectify, you know, past my absence.
Yeah, I think if there's one thing I took from this film, it's that behind this sort of, like, you describe yourself as sort of like a Virgin Mary figure, this great folk musician. There was a human with a family behind it the whole time, as there is for everybody. Joan, I loved this film, and I love getting the chance to talk to you. Thanks for making the time.
Hey, thank you very much. Take care.
10 years ago, I bought you some cufflinks. You brought me something. We both know what memories can bring. They bring diamonds and rust.
I remember it was in grade 11. My teacher, English teacher, Miss Heenahan, said, "Oh, you like folk music, hey? Do you like Joan Baez?" And I was like, "Yeah, I like Silver Dagger and all that stuff." And she played Diamonds and Rust, that song you're listening to right now. And I was like, oh boy, this is a whole other level. It's my conversation with Joan Baez. She just announced her first ever book of poetry. It's called When You See My Mother, Ask Her to Dance, and it's out April 30th. The other conversation we have up today, the uploaded to the podcast, it's a play called The Inheritance. I got three selling points for you. So if you don't get it, if you're not going to go over for these three, I don't know, one of these three, I don't know what you're going to do. I don't know. Go listen to how It Got Made or whatever that show's called. How It's Made? How Did This Get Made? That one. Okay, anyway, point being, the play's called The Inheritance. Point one, being called the most important play of the 21st century. Second point, it's really interesting. On stage, there's a conversation between generations of gay men about, you know, not forgetting the AIDS crisis, about what does gay identity mean? Is it important to even identify as a gay man anymore? That happens on stage. It was also happening backstage in rehearsals. And Brendan Healy, who's the director, will tell you what it was like for him to watch those conversations. And the third point, it's 7 hours long. And it's been packed. How do you mount a 7-hour show and make it good? Make it great. Make it sell out. Go check that out, that conversation with Brendan Healy, on our podcast, wherever you got this one. We'll see you soon. Later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.